seachtain an Indo-Ascaliger.
Táim I mon iarachtaí a dhéanamh teacht ar a chorp, agus súlagam amach an seo gur féidir é a chur in uaig ceart lena bhaintir féin.
Scíltaí, fios, tuairimí.
Tá sé dochreite nach bhféadfach ara i gcuirna meáin an cheist sin a eicáil.
Bhí an talam a gnám go raibh orthcháir in reachtam. Iadach sé tarann go raibh an orthcháir san i lis dúthail agus go mina fnacht gáir a chlig sár ducha sin éair. Ná ní bhíon ann tar d'oraach sé sin. Vin Marav.
Shachtan. Find us on all the usual podcast platforms.
Listen and follow the Left Wing Rugby podcast with me, Will Slattery, and Luke Fitzgerald.
As far as I can see, I always want to get in the Irish team. And that should be every young player's dream and ambition in this country. And if you're playing in a place where you're not going to get the opportunities in the big games, that they're the ones that get you picked. They are the ones, the Champions Cup games are the ones that get you picked. You need to be playing in a team and starting in a team for those games. It's as simple as that if you want to play in the Irish team.
Every week on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This week on Crime World.
There was a Republican police from 1920. I mean, the IRA was effectively trying to run an underground government. And actually, there was a crime wave, 1919, 1920. There's a wave of bank robberies, post office robberies, robberies of individuals, robberies of pubs in Dublin and in rural areas as well. So the IRA tried to actually clamp down on that. They, on occasion, solving bank robberies and giving the money back to the banks. Now,
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you can listen to my podcast, Crime World, wherever you get your podcasts.
The winners are the Libertines!
I think the most exciting band in rock, my personal favourite as of this minute, it is the Libertines!
At the height of his fame in the mid-2000s, Pete Doherty was the picture of rock and roll excess, constantly splashed across newspaper front pages and magazine covers. Though determined to be taken seriously as both punk and poet, it was the many personal controversies of the Libertines' frontman that provoked public scrutiny. From his high profile and tempestuous relationship with Kate Moss, to his descent into drug addiction and criminal activity.
Has anyone, while arresting you, ever asked you to sign?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Ask for your autograph while...
No, I've been face down before like that. He's been...
Yeah. You don't mind afterwards if you sign something for me son, do you?
To his link to a tragic debt that still poses unanswered questions.
When he died, the police were waiting for me outside ICU. In the lift, they started talking immediately about the fact that Pete Doherty was at the gathering that night.
The turbulent life of Pete Doherty continues to make headlines decades on from his noisy arrival into pop culture. I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today on the Indo Daily, I'm joined by music journalist Craig Fitzpatrick to look at the rise, the fall, and the rather unlikely recovery of a most notorious libertine. Craig, the name Pete Doherty was extremely prominent in the tabloids.
Yes.
And not necessarily on the music critics' pages all the time, but, you know, the front page salacious headlines. With a name like that, you kind of think, oh, he must have some sort of Irish background. Tell us about where Pete Doherty begins.
Yeah. Are you concerned about him bringing the nation into disrepute?
we're okay with the Gallagher brothers. They never go too far. But like, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. That's a low bar. Yeah, we could very much bring it back to the start and his roots. He comes from good Irish Catholic stock on his father's side. And I think maybe that's where a lot of the trouble stems from. Not to get too Freudian too early, but it was a case of, like, his grandfather came over post-World War II to London and would be found in pubs around London singing rebel songs. And then his son, Pete's dad, joined the British Army, which is just one of the dichotomies that kind of keep cropping up time and time again in Pete Doherty's life story. So that meant that essentially Pete, from an early age, was an army brat. He travelled around, no kind of real fixed abode, just sitting in army barracks, bored out of his tree. He's actually spoken about for a time he was based in Belfast when he was really young, and there was that strange dichotomy of his family being Catholic, but his dad being in the British Army stationed there, and him dealing with going to a Protestant school. So quite a, I guess, posh, you know, well-established British upbringing. He himself just innately, I think, is, and people would give him a lot of different tags and monikers, but I think a kind of great British eccentric, if we're being kind to him, because he's an interesting character, clearly a precocious child, and was destined to do things. And he did a lot of things, as we'll get into.
School-wise, was the talent spotted early?
Yeah, like his mother is actually written, she wrote a book many years ago now, My Prodigal Son, at the time when he was really in the depths of drug addiction, just talking about what a sensitive soul he was really, and this bright-eyed, really positive kid, precocious, a voracious reader. She said, you know, once I found him reading Brecht, I had to look up who Brecht was. Before his fourth birthday, we were walking through a shopping mall where pipe music was being played. Peter stopped and declared loudly, "Mummy, this is Tchaikovsky, listen." And he was right, it was Swan Lake. He was correcting headmasters at school assembly over little factual errors they made at five. So yeah, the talent was there, excelled in school, kind of got great grades, great marks. And his writing, I think, came to the fore quite quickly.
I knew she wasn't English because she spoke it far too well. The grammar was goodly and the verbs as they should be and the slang was bang on the bell. So as the language barrier clanged and banged, I couldn't hear or see England, London, and Bow crumble into the sea.
So he could, with his grades in school, have gone on to a life of professional classes and become, you know, the upper middle class in the UK. Instead, he goes down the musical route.
Yeah, I think there is an alternate timeline where Pete Doherty is a well-respected, probably underpaid poet or literary critic, carving out a nice little life for himself. But he moved to London. He was already enamoured with music and he clearly saw that as a vehicle for his writing. That's another kind of dichotomy, interesting thing with his dad. His dad had a massive vinyl collection, introduced him to punk, the Smiths, a lot of that kind of stuff that he really just hoovered up and loved. So he wanted to go and live that exciting rock and roll life in London. And boy, did he. And that was the start of everything.
Tell us about the Libertines then.
Yeah, so the Libertines start when Pete Doherty meets Carol Barat, who's, to my mind, actually his true soulmate. It's a real case of like that textbook, you know, rock and roll duo. You're Mick and Keith, you're kind of Morrissey and Marr. They just found something in each other that clicked. They met, I think Carol was dating Pete's sister. They initially didn't hit it off. There was a lot of bickering, one-upmanship. They'd argue over Coleridge quotes and things like that. But they found something special in each other. And I think Carl had quite a nice self-deprecating quote where he said, essentially, we were like two one-legged men who just strapped ourselves together and tried to learn how to walk. So there was a lot of immediate dependency there. And they formed a band, started writing songs, and they were up and running.
What does libertines mean?
Repressed man.
Unrepressed.
Or at least one who will fight repression, yeah. Free in spirit.
But you've both got tattoos on your arms saying libertines, haven't you?
He's got tattoos saying everything, but he can see.
How successful were they?
They had no success to begin with. It was the late 90s, slightly post-Britpop, and they started as a skiffle band because they were enamoured with Chaz and Dave. And something that crops up time and again is that kind of love for quaint English heritage and the, I guess, nicer cultural aspects of that culture. And yeah, they couldn't really get arrested at that stage. They were suited and booted. What happened was the Strokes, essentially. New York, there was a renaissance in kind of guitar music after quite a boring time for, you know, more mainstream guitar acts following in the wake of Oasis. You know, lovely bands and good songwriters, the likes of Travis, Coldplay, but nothing to really get the kids too excited. Suddenly you had the Strokes coming over from New York, being very glamorous, playing high octane music with great melodies. And the Libertines found a manager in Banny Pucci who basically said, ditch the suits, put on leather jackets, turn up your amps, play the songs faster, and you're good to go.
And there is this cult following that is cultivated as a result. Is that down to their talent? Is it down to his personality? What is it about? Is it about the image?
They were living the life they were singing about, I think. So it did feel like a throwback to rock stars living quite a bohemian lifestyle. There was escapism there. You could live vicariously through them. Some of those early songs, though, they're, you know, rough and ready punk songs, but the lyrics are great. Like, his penmanship was fantastic. Carl was a good songwriter. Before the wheels fell off, there is a slim volume of stuff that you can understand why there was that excitement.
Nonetheless, yeah, we now think of Pete Doherty and it's the controversies.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
At what point do the controversies start to overshadow the music?
Quite quickly. It was a very small window. I think even by the stage, like myself as a fan, became acquainted with the band, it was true stories in The Enemy, not to age myself, where it would be Pete's being kicked out of the band for breaking into Carl's flat. So like he'd left the band to go to rehab. The band had gone on tour. While they were away, he'd called around to Carl's flat in a state of disarray, realized he wasn't there, broke in essentially, took a laptop, took a guitar, went to prison for several months.
They were doing these gigs without me. He did Glastonbury. So I've gone around to speak to Carl and beg him and say, look, I know you're worried about the drugs, but please don't carry on without me.
And actually Carl was the first person waiting for him once he was released, because he essentially didn't want the first people waiting for him to be the hangers-on that would just bring him back into the drugs and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, the writing was on the wall. Like, it was a slippery slope. He fully gave in to the nihilism, I think. I think he romanticized it. You know, he thought of crack dens around Camden and rougher parts of London as being like opium dens from like the 18th century in books he read as a kid. And this was part of the character he was building. Meanwhile, he was losing his kind of sharp wit, becoming more incoherent, unreliable, and the band was more or less done. Their second album came out in 2004. It was recorded with a couple of bouncers in the studio to prevent Pete and Carl from getting into fights. By the time it came out, the band no longer existed, and it was released to critical acclaim, but they were already gone. So very kind of ephemeral.
How divisive is this personality then at this point? Because he's got this big following of young people.
Yeah.
And, you know, nowadays we call them influencers, but they are also, you know, he is glamorizing this lifestyle.
It's really a case of one of the last times maybe like that rock and roll became a mainstream cultural mover, but also concern for parents. Like, it feels quite quaint now to be like, you know, this rock and roller is going to corrupt your children. But yeah, I think it was certainly the case that there was people in proximity to those London shows would have probably gone down a slippery slope because of what was happening around the band. Very easy to get enthralled to that kind of thing. Pete himself being, of course, you know, a victim of addiction and mental health struggles himself. But of course, mental health struggles aren't your fault, but they are your responsibility.
The reason he was also getting on front pages was because of his love life. There's a famous relationship with Kate Moss.
A lot of the time it's just, oh, look, it's Kate Moss's boyfriend, which is like obviously really hurtful to my pride. You know what I mean? It's not, oh, look, there's that really talented lyricist and Irish impersonator.
He became this emblem for a counterculture. He was the rocker of the moment. He was, you know, both kind of called out as a buffoon in some outlets, but he would be appearing on Newsnight and BBC kind of poetry reviews. So this kind of weird mishmash of high culture. And within all of that, he hooks up with Kate Moss. So they were moving in similar circles, by all accounts. The relationship started in quite a clandestine fashion, but it wasn't long before suddenly they were splashed all over the tabloids.
So he's literally living the sex, drugs, rock and roll lifestyle. He is the epitome of all of that. But the drugs, though, it's out of control.
It's getting to a point where just every image you would see of him, he's looking quite gaunt. He's around that age of 27 where that ridiculously mythologized thing of like, that's when rock stars, you know, live fast and die young. And it did seem like there would be a new story any day that he would be found somewhere having passed away. Luckily, that was not the case.
Do you think the press have made you out to be more of a junkie than you are? Is that unfair? Have they been unfair?
Yeah, definitely. But that's part of it, isn't it?
And there are people sounding alarm bells here. I mean, his family, his father in particular, is cutting off contact with him, saying doesn't want anything to do with him as long as he's using an addict.
Yeah, yeah.
So there are people trying to support him and get him back on the straight and narrow.
For sure. And his former bandmates, I mean, Carl remained a friend. I think the way Pete has talked about it was like, you know, we stuck together through thin and thin and thinner. And they're very much back together now. But he would try and make his way into that kind of murky world that Pete found himself in and not want to get dragged into it himself, try and make the case to get on the straight and narrow. It wouldn't really succeed. His mother does talk about like meeting him just on a break from rehab, having really great conversations with him, him talking about going back and getting on the straight and narrow. And as they're talking at this cafe, there's fans approaching him. He's signing stuff. Someone comes over with a guitar. Suddenly his mother is lost in the crowd of adoration and he's gone again. The fleeting moment where he had that moment of clarity is gone and he's lost in the chaos again.
In the midst of all this, though, there is a very, very serious incident in 2006. Can you tell us about the tragedy that occurred there?
Yeah. So away from all the kind of rock and roll mythologizing and the tabloid headlines, there was the death of Mark Blanco, which occurred in 2006. Mark Blanco was only 30 years old. He was a Cambridge graduate, I believe, talented kind of creative, an actor. And essentially, he turned up at a party that was being held by a man that was styling himself as Pete Doherty's literary agent, Paul Roundhill. And it wasn't a great scene at this party. There was a lot of drug taking. Accounts are kind of foggy, but it would seem that Mark Blanco turned up quite late in the night. He was himself inebriated and he kind of quite aggressively was trying to talk to Pete about a play he was about to perform in and try and get Pete to come. And he was, you know, acting out slightly in a way that was upsetting everyone at the party. He was removed from the party by one of Pete's minders, a guy that goes by the name of Johnny Headlock. And again, this is the kind of crew that was now surrounding Pete Doherty. And essentially, this all culminated with Mark Blanco being found on the pavement outside the flat, clinging to life. He sadly didn't make it. And since then, what has happened is obviously a distraught mother trying to get justice for her son. A lot of unanswered questions, police work that was called into question. Initially, the case was made that this was suicide off a balcony, which then seemed to have no weight whatsoever. Questions are still out there. The most upsetting thing from a point of view of Pete's involvement in this, which obviously isn't the main focus of what this story should be, but there was CCTV footage of him walking past the lifeless body of Mark Blanco at the scene with some of his entourage and just running off. Now, he's talked about it being, of course, I was extremely high on drugs at this point. I had stuff on me. My immediate thought was my own survival and there will be police coming and clearly a person not making correct decisions. So he hightailed it. But if you're the mother of Mark Blanco and you want answers and you see footage like that and you still see Pete back with his band and doing the PR rounds, I mean, that's a very tough pill to swallow.
When he died, the police were waiting for me outside ICU in the lift. They started talking immediately about the fact that Pete Doherty was at the gathering that night. And they were saying, yeah, you know, Pete Doherty, boyfriend of Kate Moss. And saying, and yes, did you know that flat has been a drug den for 25 years? I didn't know what to say, quite honestly. But I knew there was something strange, the way the police looked at each other. A kind of a smirk, you know. They knew something that I didn't.
No, because as you say, if back in the day Pete Doherty had ended up dead from an overdose, yeah, Nobody would have been surprised. That seems to be the path he was on. He's cleaned himself up, though.
He has. And I think since 2019, he has been pretty much drug-free. Now, I will say his definition of being clean is off hard drugs. So you will still see him in interviews with a drink in his hand. He is someone with an appetite for life in general, but it does seem like his main thing now is like he's living in France and French cheese seems to be the thing that intrigues him the most at this point. So he's had an opiate blocker implanted, which he'd previously done and dug out with his fingers scissors and a knife. This time it stayed there for many, many years. He's found a steady relationship. He's living in rural France with his partner, Kathia. And yeah, he's back with the Libertines. And Carol actually bought a hotel in Margate, which they, of course, dubbed the Albion Rooms, because he essentially wanted a stable place for Pete to have a roof over his head. But they're running it as an actual hotel. You can go and stay there. And they do seem to spend quite a lot of time there. And it's a lot more wholesome these days. So he's moving between Margate and France, living a quiet, reserved life. And it sounds strange to say, but he's, you know, he's kind of packed on the pounds a bit.
I mean, they told me a little while ago as well, if you don't change your diet and stop drinking, then you're going to have diabetes and cholesterol problems, you know. Death's lurking, you know what I mean?
He's a bit unrecognisable from his heroin chic days. And as someone that has followed their career, anytime you see him like that, you kind of can rest easy and go, oh, that means he's probably off the hard stuff.
At the height of his fame, as we discussed, his problems were overshadowing his music. He didn't seem to appreciate this, that people would ask him about his drug taking in particular and the damage it was doing to his life. There's a memorable interview with Pat Kenny.
Yeah, like the way you've been talking to me about drugs and Kate or whatever, it's that's the first thing in your mind when you think of me. I'd rather, like, I mean, I don't know if you could even name a song that I've written.
Possibly not, no.
Well, I'd like to change that for a start, you know. I'd like you to, you know, I'd like to imprint a melody in your heart and in your head and have that as the way you think of me.
Did he have a point there, or could you, on the other hand, turn around and go, you know, was this guy all he's, is he as big a deal as he thinks he was in terms of his talent? Did he really match up to the legend?
Yeah, I think if you look back on his legacy of work, he doesn't have, you know, a rainy night in Soho there. There isn't, you know, a fairy tale New York that will kind of be added to the canon. There are some great songs, and Fiona and I will make you a playlist and try and convince you. But I think it was a case of a lot of talent squandered. But there was a lot of talent there. He is a very good writer. He has a way with melody, but just poor choices along the way. You know, for a period, part of the charm was it was chaotic. You didn't know what was going to happen next when they were on stage. The interaction between Pete and Carol, like, it was very affectionate, sharing a mic. I think actually importantly as well, for that time when lad rock was a thing, they were kind of quite open and sensitive and showed a nod to femininity and not having to play up to those stereotypes, which I think is an important part of their legacy. And yeah, I think it's more his place in the culture as representing maybe the last hurrah of rock and roll as a countercultural force that, however you want to comment on the quality, actually could scare parents. And that's something that probably isn't going to come back.
And my thanks to Craig Fitzpatrick. I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today's episode of the Indo Daily was produced by Dave Hanratty and Ian Doyle, with sound by Rory Bones. Archive clips from the BBC, MTV, The Late Late Show, Louis Theroux interviews, Channel 4 documentary Debt at a Party, Friday Night with Jonathan Ross, and the Associated Press. If you enjoy the Indo Daily, don't forget to follow and leave us a review.
Remember, you can stay up to date on the latest news with the Irish Independent WhatsApp channel.